our meaning and purpose. You know, we've lost our purpose, and it's one of the things that I talk about. You know, whether you believe in a specific religion, a denomination, I don't care. Higher power, the universe, you know, that's kind of my jam, you know. And I've been, you know, I've been LDS, I've been Catholic, I've been Baptist, like I've been baptized in all three. So gosh, my sins have been cleaned. No, I'm just kidding. But at the end of the day, like having something that you believe in is extremely important, because if you don't have a purpose, you don't feel fulfilled.
Thank you for tuning in to the Critical Conversations podcast, brought to you by Mind the Frontline. Established in 2023 as a 501c3, Mind the Frontline is your ally in the journey to support those who selflessly safeguard our communities. Their core mission revolves around pioneering innovation in research, education, and overall well-being, specifically tailored to healthcare, military, and public service frontline first responders. The Critical Conversation podcast is a dedicated space for police, fire, EMS, allied health workers, dispatchers, air medical, and military personnel, along with their families. Here, we dive into the heart of the matter, tackling essential topics such as mental health strategies, recovery methods, treatment options, the latest research, and professional development opportunities. Before we dive into today's episode on Critical Conversations, we do want to, however, acknowledge the nature of our discussions. Some of the content discussed may be triggering or intense as we explore the challenges and the triumphs within the first responder community. We recognize that these discussions may evoke strong emotions or memories. If you or someone you know is struggling and needs immediate support, we urge you to reach out to your agency's mental health resources or your local peer support group. In time of mental health crisis, you can always contact the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline by phone or via text at 988. Please remember, you are never alone and help is always available. At Mind the Frontline, we are more than just a podcast. We are a community committed to fostering resilience within the entire first responder family. So whether you're on the front lines or supporting those who are, we invite you to subscribe, engage, and be a part of this vital mission. To learn more, please visit us at www.mindthefrontline.org. Now let's dive into today's critical conversation.
Welcome back to Critical Conversations by Mind the Frontline, the podcast for first responders, listeners, and members of the frontline community. In today's episode, we'll be discussing trauma-informed care for crisis intervention. Our guest speaker for this episode is the amazing Morgan Pickering. Morgan began her EMS career in Hall County in 2015 and later transitioned into the field of mental health in about 2019. She is currently a certified peer specialist and a certified peer counselor, mental health resiliency officer, and EMS crisis intervention officer. Her wealth of knowledge, her experience, and just her story are so inspiring. I can't wait to dive into this episode. Morgan will help us in our ongoing mission to foster resilience within the first responder community. Let's dive into today's episode and learn some valuable insights and key takeaways from our trauma-informed guest. Welcome, Morgan, to the Critical Care Podcast.
I am very excited to be here. Thank you very much. I'm very excited.
Absolutely. You know, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yes. So I am a mental health specialist. I specialize specifically in traumatic studies, harm reduction, suicide prevention, and crisis intervention. And I'm very passionate about all of these particular topics, trauma specifically, because I am a cumulative trauma survivor. And one of the things that I love to bring to the conversation is that being a first responder, oftentimes when we talk about first responders and mental health and PTSD and crisis and such, we limit things to on-the-job traumas. And not always does trauma only happen on the job. Speaking for myself, do you mind if I share kind of how I got into the field, like the story behind all of it? I grew up in a military family. My father was military. Almost every male in my family has served in the armed forces in some capacity. I am an only child, and I grew up kind of the black sheep of the family. You won't find me in the family holiday photos. So I spent a lot of time alone. You know, I didn't have a nice, you know, warm, happy place to go home to. And oftentimes I received the brunt of my father's rage, which meant that I experienced a lot of physical abuse. And by the time I was in high school, I was working multiple jobs to take care of myself. And when I graduated, I thought that it was a great idea to get married, because I wanted to leave home like really bad. And I ended up marrying a police officer. And unbeknownst to me, and unbeknownst to a lot of folks who live in trauma, sometimes we go, there's the term comfort and chaos. And so I went from one domestic violence situation to another. And I lived in that particular marriage for approximately 4 years. And when I left, I lived voluntarily homeless. And during that time, I was in EMT school. And I remember that I was struggling. I cannot fathom how I finished EMT school, to be honest. And I was really quiet, very reserved, because I was living in constant fear. And so I was homeless and living in domestic violence while in EMT school, and nobody knew. So I graduated EMT school. Wow. And then I left my husband and lived approximately 6 months homeless. And during that time, I experienced a good bit of self-destructive behavior because I was starved for attention, and sought it in any capacity that I could get it. And while I was living in chaos, I met my current husband, and he quite literally picked me up off the street and gave me a whole new life. And you know, you would think that that would be my happily ever after. I would go forth and live this blissful life and everything was just great. And it was for a short time. And then I started noticing some self-destructive behavior again. I was attention seeking by people that I had no business seeking attention from. I was very angry, you know, put myself in situations that I otherwise wouldn't. And I didn't really have an answer for it. I couldn't understand why. And so I decided to go to therapy and try therapy for the first time. And it was then at the age of 26 that I learned that everything I had experienced was traumatic. I had no idea. I thought it was all normal. I thought everybody, you know, was beaten the way that I was. And I thought everybody was, you know, I thought that how I was treated by my family was normal. And when I learned that it was not normal, I became very angry. And, you know, we talk often about the stages of grief. Grief is not just for death. Grief can be for the things that happened or didn't happen, or the people that existed or didn't exist. Or, you know, it's not just for death. And so I began acting out. I put myself in situations that were life or death. One of your previous guests, Kyle Atkins, he and I were working together at the time, and I was a very angry person. I was not a good person. I hated everyone, hated everything, hated myself more than anyone could ever imagine. And then my life started spiraling out of control. So I'm in therapy at this point. I have just learned that what I had experienced in life was not normal. And then my life started spiraling out of control. And what I mean by that is that within a one year's time, I was physically and sexually assaulted on the ambulance. Both of my in-laws passed away, which now meant that I had a grieving husband. I bought a house and moved to a different part of the state. My father, who was my primary abuser, was diagnosed with cancer and then used it to mentally torture me. I witnessed the aftermath of a murder that I had personal ties. I was in a car accident that left scars on my body. Should not have walked away from it, but I did. I became pregnant and then I had that child prematurely. So all of those things in a 1 year's time frame, throw in the fact that I experienced two life-altering betrayals. So I was a ticking time bomb. And on Mother's Day of 2017, at the age of 27, I attempted suicide. And I was hospitalized for a week. When I returned to work, as you can imagine, because of stigma, nobody reached out to me. I never heard from anyone from command staff, never heard from any coworkers, nobody. I very much just kind of faded off into the distance. And no one really knew how to talk to me because I was so angry and so upset and so depressed. And of course, hindsight being 2020, I kind of understand why no one really wanted to anything to do with me. But nonetheless, it was a very lonely time for me. And so I continued with the self-destructive behavior because I had no other way of really processing the things that not only had already happened to me, but were currently happening to me. And by the time I turned 30, I had burnt my entire life down to the ground. I had no one. I had lost my job. I had no friends. I had no mentors. I had nothing. And I had ruined my home life because of my self-destructive behavior. So I kind of made this vow to myself that I would grow up when I'm 30. And here I am 33. And I have taken all of my cumulative experiences, learned as much clinical knowledge as I can possibly learn. And I now use a combination of the two to inspire others, but also to make changes with crisis intervention and implementing trauma-informed care. And, you know, essentially making it a point to be a walking example that just because we have gone through these things doesn't mean that we can't recover from them and completely turn our life around. We don't have to remain the angry, apathetic, you know, shell of a human. And, you know, us as first responders, we live with cumulative trauma all the time, because just because we see things at work, which are, you know, distressing, of course, there are things outside of that that are traumatic. You know, when we have, you know, maybe our spouse attempt suicide, or we have a special needs family member, or, you know, natural disasters, maybe we lose our house in a tornado or something. And those are all compressed stress responses. So work is not the only trauma that first responders really deal with.
It's not, you know, and that, wow, that is such a powerful, powerful story, Morgan. And thank you for sharing that and being so vulnerable and transparent. It, cumulative trauma is something that I think it's always a question I've had, when you look at, or especially like me, when I look back, you know, I look back and go, okay, well, I did have childhood trauma. I had unresolved childhood trauma, that carried into a career full of more trauma. And I always wonder, you know, when I look at people that may have gone through, you know, they're 20, 30 years in, they're retiring. I'm like, and they seem chipper and happy and positive and upbeat. I'm like, man, what is the secret sauce? The other conversation I had the other day with the doctor medic and Justin Hunter, you know, we were kind of talking about it. And I don't know if the world's ready just yet for this, this kind of type of episode, but really looking at, you know, should we be screening individuals that come into public safety and first responders to help them identify maybe some underlying trauma, knowing that by getting into this field, it is going to amplify that, you know, and those self-destructive behaviors that I've experienced as an alcoholic. You know, I was, I would come home and be angry as well. I was angry at the world, like anybody, you know, everything just set me off, you know? And I think when you talk about trauma-informed care, you know, it's more rooted in the understanding of the prevalence and the impact of trauma on individuals and communities. And you're right. It can happen outside of, you know, public safety. You know, it could happen with just the loss of a home. It could be something that happened to them as a child or as a spouse. You know, those are all things that can continue to carry, or at least, you know, what I think is snowball what we see in the field. Right. And I was talking to Cindy Jones with BiTAP, and she was mentioning, you know, about this, you know, window of basically care, you know, and we only have so much. You know, we have a, you know, I felt like when I got into the profession, I had a very narrow window. So if any stress, any cumulative things that came in after that was extremely just setting off and off-putting. And some people don't have that one to get into profession, you know, but I also understand, like, the research by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, you know, they definitely highlight the core principles of trauma-informed care. You know, talk about, you know, feeling safe, you know, trustworthiness, collaboration, being empowered, cultural humility, you know, and recognizing those signs and its effects on our mental health as first responders. I mean, when you talk about trauma-informed care, you know, what does it mean to you, Morgan? What does that bring forth? What's that first thought?
So trauma-informed care to me is a concept that when we're interacting with folks, we are part of a lot of people's traumatic event. And that's something that I don't feel a lot of first responders really think about. We are part of their traumatic event. We are there. Agreed. When they are having the brain go offline. We are there when someone is hysterical. We are there when someone is getting the worst news of their life. And so how we respond to folks in their own traumatic event has a ripple effect. You know, we're the first people oftentimes that folks try to hug, you know, we're the first folks that offer a simple touch in a traumatic event, depending on what it is. And we hold the power to impact that event for the good or the worse. We have the power to either make something a little less traumatic or make it even more traumatic. And I don't feel that that's talked about enough, or at least that perspective isn't mentioned very often. So trauma-informed care to me is a concept of acknowledging being part of someone's traumatic event, or acknowledging that the reason that someone is acting a particular way is due to trauma. It's like, for example, domestic violence. You know, I can't tell you, well, I have personally actually been I wouldn't say accused, but speculated to not be telling the truth, because in a traumatic event, the prefrontal cortex of our brain goes completely offline. And as you may know, that's where our reasoning is. That's where our personality is. That's where all of our rational thinking is. And during a traumatic event, we're functioning on our animal brain. And so you can, like, let's say that domestic violence, we'll say female for my particular experiences, being asked a question about what happened. I know what happened. And if I wasn't so activated, I could tell you what happened, but I can't articulate it because my brain's not allowing that to happen in this event. But that doesn't necessarily mean that I'm lying or that what happened didn't happen. It just means that in that moment, I can't articulate it. And I feel like that is a looked over trauma response. Because oftentimes when we don't know the answer, we say, we don't know. I don't know. I don't know, but we do know. And then another example is, you know, one of the car accidents that I've been in, and I'm having to call and give my location. I know where I'm at. I drive this route all the time, but I can't articulate to be able to tell anyone where I'm at. And I don't feel that is recognized in the moment. And so one of the things that I hope to do is to bring that perspective of the fact that we are such a key component in a traumatic event.
I couldn't echo that anymore, but you made some good points I want to kind of touch on real quick. You know, when you talk about, you know, we lose control. And really what that is just your amygdala is hijacked, right? You know, there's someone else in the driver's seat, and that that I call him the asshole, because really that's what he was for me. You know, you get so hyper stimulated due to that traumatic event, whether it be a car accident, spousal abuse, a domestic violence, a sexual assault, you seeing or witnessing some form of trauma in the line of duty. You know, what happens is your brain gets hijacked and we just become irrational. And I think a lot of people just don't realize that. You know, I've had people, especially myself, you know, now that I have a little bit more emotional intelligence and I've been in recovery for the last couple of years, I've been sober, you know, that has been a huge help. But a lot of people get hijacked and they just don't have that rational thinking. So they have irrational responses, you know. For example, you know, when you look at police officers and things like that, you know, when they might have an adverse event. I just read today on the news where a Chicago PD officer was basically arrested and terminated for, you know, having one of his arrestees or perpetrators, you know, perform a sexual act. You know, when initially you take a look at, you know, I before would be like, oh man, that is a disgusting guy. He abuses power, you know, but in reality, when we are in that trauma, we make irrational thoughts, you know, and when people kind of take a look. And so I have to wonder, you know, with this individual, is he going through some sort of trauma response? Is he going through some sort of emotional distress, mental distress? And he is not, or she is not able to make rational decisions. You know, for me, for example, you know, just having, you know, it's just little things, little triggers that set you off, but you respond completely irrationally to something that's very small. Like the general public, you know, someone who may not be experiencing trauma, you know, they would look at you and go, man, that's a really crazy person. I actually had someone say that today about a patient in a clinic I was covering for. And I kind of just kind of like, I took it in and I just like, you know, maybe they're just kind of going through some stuff and, you know, maybe we should just better understand kind of what's going on versus just kind of write them off right off the bat as, oh, they're just a crazy person. You're going to have to deal with them. You know, and it wasn't for recovery. If it wasn't for recovery, more importantly, I wouldn't have had that emotional intelligence to kind of stop and pause. I would have jumped on the band train like everybody else. And that's what typically happens in EMS. And that's why we have that stigma. It's like, you know, everybody jumps on like, oh, you know, Chris is crazy. You know, he's lashing out. He's being, you know, angry. He's very reactive. He's very emotional. You know, slamming doors at home, you know, going off on my kids for leaving stuff on the floor, like just little stupid shit. And really at the end of the day, it was just, and I wasn't even aware of it. That's the shitty part. Like you're not even aware of it. And until I became aware and I could get my amygdala and kick that asshole out of the driver's seat and really kind of take over again, you don't see it. And that's why I kind of call it a fog, because you just don't understand why you're doing what you do. Sometimes I would be in that moment going, why am I so hyperreactive? Why am I such an asshole? Why am I so angry at the world and mean to my own family? Because typically it's the loved ones, those that are closest to you, that you take it out on the most, because, you know, you have that established kind of relationship. And so it just, and you don't mean to, it just happens. And I like, you know, when you talk about trauma-informed care, it's just the approach to a patient or a colleague or a friend or a family member that just kind of has that speculation. And when you approach it, like, instead of you approaching like, oh, Chris is an asshole, you know, he's just a dick. You approach it like, oh, I wonder what's going on in Chris's life, you know, and looking for some of those signs. And it's just a different it's a humble approach to what might be going on with that patient or with that individual, because trauma is it's a spectrum of experiences, right? And some folks have experienced far more than one traumatic event, you know, and most people in their lifetime will experience some form of trauma, but those that have that compounding cumulative trauma, it doesn't go away. You don't get that chance to kick the amygdala out of the seat, reset, come back down, regroup, decompress, really take a look at yourself and figure out, okay, well, what was my part in this? How could I do this better? You don't get that pause. You don't get that momentary pause at all. It's just like, go, go, go. And you just react, react, react until, you know, something bad happens. You know, it could be, you know, anything. You know, they blow up at work, they start drinking, they get caught drinking on the job, you know, DUIs, you know, sex on the job. And that's common. You know, if a lot of people didn't realize that, like getting caught for having sex with a colleague or sex on the job, you know, is a common trauma response because it's just so irrational. And when you look at this person, and it's hard because if you have cumulative trauma, you know, it always looks like you've just been an asshole or a dick or a Karen for a while, you know, whatever that looks like. But in reality, you know, if someone truly knew you, like I had a really good friend and they knew who I was and they were like, man, over the last couple of years, I've really seen some changes in you. But if you were someone that just met me last week or last month, you wouldn't know that. You would just think that this is Chris all the time. And that's that cumulative trauma.
Yeah, it's interesting that you would give that example because, you know, I mentioned that Kyle and I used to work together. And when Kyle and I worked together, I was very angry. I was that EMT in the day room that, like, I would just wait for someone just to say some slick shit just so I'd have a reason to try to fight them. I mean, when I lost my job, and it was shortly after I was sexually assaulted on the ambulance, I can tell you right now I was not doing myself any favors. My employee file was about this thick, full of insubordination, fighting, complaints, write-ups. I was not doing myself any favors. But knowing what I know now, I know that if I was to notice that in someone else, they got some stuff going on. And that was, you know, the folks that I worked with at the time, they really had no idea what to do with me. I didn't know what to do with me. And so I had a reputation of just being this angry, just a bitch. And now, I'm nowhere near that same person. And I have to deal with the fact that that was my impression that I left on a lot of people. And while, of course, we always want to kind of clear up, you know, when we've made changes and whatever, but I let it rest because there is no louder recovery than what I'm doing now and who I was just 4 years ago. Yeah. It's very interesting. And then even now when I'm sharing my story with folks that I work with counseling and, you know, elsewhere, they're almost like, I can't believe that you did that. Like, I can't believe that that was you. And it's like,
they can't even believe who you were. They're like, this was you?
Yes. Yes. You know, I did a lot of really self-destructive stuff. You know, I'll spare you those details, but I've done a lot. How I am not dead or in prison is a miracle beyond my understanding.
Well, sometimes there's something, you know, like to think of a higher power or you have this destiny and obviously that brought you here on the show and what you're doing behind the scenes, you know, working with other people as a trauma therapist, you know, and you're right, you know, I have the same problem. I call that the emotional hangover almost. You know, it's like when you finally start into recovery, you start realizing all these things. And that's why I try to inform people. I try to let them know, like, it gets heavy after you start trying to say, hey, I'm getting better, right? Like when you get better, you kind of have this, at least I did, right? Like I was like, hey, as soon as I get the therapy and I start doing some of these things, like, I'm just going to be a whole different guy. The switch is going to flip, so to speak. And it just doesn't work that way. What ends up happening is you start getting that wherewithal, you get that emotional intelligence and awareness, and you start realizing just what kind of person you were. And that doesn't need to necessarily define who you will become, right? That does not define what I do tomorrow or next month. That is just a phase of my life. I like to look back at it because I learned a lot from that. Once I was able to snap out of my trauma, I was able to really look at myself, the part I played, and you really kind of, I used it more or less as part of a catalyst for my recovery and for my healing and to really just transform myself into this new Chris. I've kind of shed that old skin off, kind of like a snake, you know, just getting rid of its exoskeleton. I kind of shed that off and there's this new Chris. And I don't know what this new Chris looks like, but I can tell you, at least I like this guy a lot better than the last guy because my wife sees a difference. My family sees a difference. My friend, more importantly, my kids really do see a difference. And that's important because I think people need to understand that it does get sometimes a little bit more heavy and that's normal. That's to be, expected. And you got to just kind of be careful with that negative self-talk, because you can get up in your head real quick and go right back to that old Chris. And I don't want to do that. You know, I want to stay away from that guy as much as I can. He's kind of like my Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, you know, so to speak. It's, for me, it's being able to recognize where I was, appreciate that, because that's who, you know, and that's what's made me the person I am today and the mission that I'm on now. So kudos to you. You know, you recognize where you were and you understand, you know, that was not who you wanted to be. You didn't have intent. And oftentimes we don't have control. We really, truly do not have control of our reactions in those situations because of that that cumulative stress. It really just kind of takes over. And, you know, so I guess, and you mentioned this, and I kind of want to, I think this is a good segue to the next topic, but, you know, a lot of your crew members did not really know what to do with you. They like, I'm not going to touch Morgan with a 20-foot pole. I'm just going to stay right over here. I had my own crew members. I had leaders. I had managers that just like, yeah, just let Chris do his thing. Like, just let him go. You know, nobody came up to talk to me about my drinking. The only person that really, and I respect the hell out of them, was, one of my cousins, one of my wife's cousins. We were out in Oregon and we're doing a family trip. And I, you know, even my best friends didn't say anything, you know, but I would drink from pretty much waking up to get rid of the shakes. And I was, you know, maybe not sloppy, or at least in my own words, but yeah, dude, I didn't stop. I didn't put that bottle down or that beer down. It was constant, just drink, because I was trying not to deal with the anxiety and the depression and all the negative talks going on my head. And at least I felt like if I drank that, you know, I didn't care anymore. I really didn't. I kind of got numb, and that's what I was going for. And that was my unhealthy coping mechanisms, because nobody taught me good coping mechanisms. But more importantly, like, my friends and family, just, you know, other than my wife, you know, nobody really said anything. They really didn't know what to do. And so I guess my next question to you is, like, you know, when we talk about implementing trauma-informed approaches, especially in a crisis situation, you know, what are some of those things that, you know, my partners or people listening that can look out? Because this is what I tell people. Nobody's coming to save us. We got to save ourselves. The best way to do that is to be vocal and to stand up and really kind of look for some of these signs that we're talking about in other people and have that conversation. But I do know a lot of people just, they don't know where to start. They don't know where to begin. They want to. They see this person that they love so much destroying their life, but they have no idea how to approach that situation. How do I make that first touch?
So I'm going to share a little bit of a story. In the midst, okay. This was the day after my suicide attempt. I went to work in uniform and I was determined to pretend that nothing happened. And there was this paramedic, who I considered a mentor. And I remember he was like, come talk to me. And I'm like, I don't want to freaking talk to you. He's like, no, we need to talk. And I'm like, okay. So he pulls me aside and he goes, I really want you to talk to me and tell me what's going on. And I fought him. I was like, you're going to go home tonight and my problems aren't going to keep you up at night. I'm going to be the one that goes home and cries myself to sleep. You're not going to think twice about any problems that I've got going on. So what the hell do you want? And he just, you know, didn't really know how to take that, because I was very brutal. You know, I just assumed that no one gave a shit. And I remember that he looked at me, and he was a man of very few words. And he looked me in my face and he says, I'm only going to tell you this once. And he said, there are still some people in this business that believe in the brotherhood. And if you continue going the way that you're going, you're going to end up alone. And that's exactly what happened. I more or less FAFO'd on that. And, I did end up alone. I've never forgotten that person that I looked up to. I thought he was very wise, and he was a preceptor of mine while I was in EMT school. And he was one of the only preceptors I had that taught me without making me feel like an idiot, which was, you know, an internal complex of mine anyway. But for him to sit there and just be like, I'm only going to tell you this once. This brotherhood is still alive amongst several of us, and I'm one of them. And, you know, extending you know, an actual token of caring, giving a shit, because no one else did. Mm-hmm. I mean, my whole command staff could, I mean, they had no clue what to do with me. And then, you know, how do people approach, you know, folks who are in crisis? And I feel like that was a really good example of one. But also like recognizing that that coworker that we have that is just angry at the world, they hate everyone, they hate everything. Instead of being like, man, what is wrong with you? Man, what happened? How did we get here? You know, what this is a series of events. Mm-hmm. Where did this start? And there's very high possibility that another person would be like, you know, why am I going to sit here and talk to you? You don't care. You're going to go home tonight and you're not going to think twice about my problems. You're not going to fix anything. But then also the power of presence. So as a cumulative trauma survivor, and also, as someone who is in pretty intense therapy and has been for quite some time, sometimes talking is not what I need. You know, when we're down and out, our responsibilities pile up. And, you know, I personally cannot stand when someone's like, oh, let me know if you just need to talk. I don't need to talk. I need someone to come do my dishes. I need someone to take my kids for a weekend. I need someone to help me with laundry. I need someone to run to the grocery store for me because I'm drowning. I need someone to show up. And I went to a support group for my own personal well-being last night, and I was amongst a lot of police officers. And they were talking about how they take care of one another. And like, we can go on and on about command staff all day long. I'm not going to go down that rabbit hole, but they were talking about the things that they've done for each other when they were each suffering. And I'm sitting here thinking, you know, that's not very common in EMS. You know, you've got law enforcement and they're very much a brotherhood, and you've got the fire service, you know,
yes, they are.
Sit down and eat together on a regular basis. But with EMS, we don't have that. It's a sink or swim out there. And so the power of presence and actually showing up, donating your time for more than just listening to someone's gossip, or, you know, let me just, because I'm nosy and I want to know, you know, what's going on with this person. Those of us who have experienced trauma and grew up in it, we can smell that on someone. We can smell awful intentions.
You can smell it so quick.
Oh, yes. And so, you know, that's my biggest thing, is like actually caring, not just wanting to know what the story is. You know, and I mentioned going to a support group. I have lived as a hypocrite myself, even as a counselor. Going to support groups for my own personal well-being and not being the facilitator is still a new concept for me. I'm also a really big advocate for a warm line. So, you know, we talk about social circles. I have a triangle and I'm content with that. You know, that's, you know, to be debated by folks, but I'm very content with my triangle. And so when I need to talk and someone in my triangle is not available, I use the warm line. And, you know, I'm sure you've heard about hotlines and crisis lines. Well, a warm line is not for crisis. It's a preventative. Mm-hmm. You know, I get on the warm line. I've been on the warm line at 3 o'clock in the morning, and they have had to talk me down from reverting back to my old ways for sure. But it's confidential and it's something that I can use anytime I need it. And, you know, I ain't got to worry about my business getting out to everybody to listen, or I don't have to worry about being judged because someone can't relate to me. You know, I'm assuming that you've heard of Cop Line.
Yep, I have heard of Cop Line. They're one of our resources, you know, on there. We also have, Mind the Frontline has its own, we call it a debrief hotline, where basically, you know, it's another layer of anonymity. You know, if they don't want to talk to their triangle or there's something else going on and they just want to, hey, I don't want, and it's all preventative, right? Because what we're trying to encourage is that they don't need to necessarily take this on to the next call, back to the station. Or more importantly, you don't have to take this home. You know, give us a call. We got 17 peer support responders. It's a 24/7 manned hotline with frontline first responders that are culturally competent and trained. And it's completely anonymous. You know, people can just call and just blow off steam. And when you talk about you know, trauma-informed approaches in crisis situations. I like some of the points that you made, you know, and I want to give some people just general tips and tricks because I love giving them something to walk away from in these episodes. So like you mentioned, you know, there's standard, you know, when we talk about like active listening, validation of emotions, providing a sense of control, mainly just providing a sense of safety, right? Those are all kind of effective techniques. So how do you approach someone that is like Morgan and they're like, hey, I ain't having none of that? First off, it might take more than one time and you need to be aware of that. You know, if you're reaching out to a friend, you're doing a buddy checks, you're really concerned about someone. I love how you do it. I feel like if individuals approach it from a level of humility and caring versus like, hey, tell me your business, it's more like, I really care about you, Morgan. I really noticed that, you know, you haven't been yourself. And I know that's not the Morgan that I know, you know, and I just want to let you know, like, I'm here if you want to blow off some steam, if you just want to chat, you know, hey, let's go for a walk. Let's go for a hike. Hey, would it be possible? You know, I know you got a lot going on in your life. You know, can I stop by and drop off some dinner tonight or tomorrow, or what'd be a good night? And I don't give them the option like to say no. I go, hey, what night can I drop off some food for you? Or, hey, we're going to go hiking on Saturday. And I try to get people outside. And that's why that's one of the things behind Mind the Front Line is the first responder experience. It's to get them outdoors where they can start movement, right? Because we do know that movement, walking, bilateral stimulation or BLS, like all of these things help to destimulate the amygdala and really bring it back down to the point where we can actually manage it. It brings it back into our window, you know, but until we get out of that hyper arousal state and that trauma, that fight or flight, like alarms, I'm not safe, I'm not going to trust anybody, until we can get down here, it's like trying to talk to a 2-year-old and telling them what to do while they're crying. It ain't happening, folks. It just ain't, you're not getting through. So what you can do is continue to come in and approach it with love, approach it with kindness and be gentle. Like that's the best thing you can do is just, and let them know. And maybe it doesn't happen. Maybe you get that same response that Morgan gave on her mentor. But if you go back the next shift or the next day and check in again, send them another text. Hey, I just want to let you know, I thought about you last night. I'm still here. It doesn't matter how mean you're going to get to me. You're just not going to break me. And I just want to let you know that I would really like to help you out. I just don't know how. So if it's doing the laundry, if it's cooking dinner, hey, you want to go have just a night off for yourself? Drop off your kids at 5 o'clock and come, we'll drop them off tomorrow morning. And that, you know, and just whatever you feel comfortable with, obviously. But these are other tools that aren't commonly talked about. And I want to give you guys all that, you know, all our viewers and listeners, just other tools to think outside the box, because it doesn't always have to be, hey, yeah, tell me your story. Hey, my phone's always on. And that was something, and I still say this, I really do. My phone's always on, but in the moment, sometimes they don't give a shit about that. They're like, I don't care if your phone's on. Your phone ain't going to fix my problem. Your phone ain't going to take away my nightmares or my flashbacks. Your phone ain't going to give me money. You know, it's like, okay, but do what you can do. You know, hey, let's go bowling. Let's go, you know, let's go to a concert. Let's go do an event. You know, there's so much going on, and it doesn't have to cost money. It's just getting outside and providing and really letting that person know that A, you are genuine and you do care, and B, that this is safe. You're in a safe place. This doesn't go anywhere. And I really do try to reiterate that in a lot of my conversations with people that I talk to that are in crisis or need a talk, and let them know like, hey, this stays between you, me, and the drywall. It doesn't go anywhere. And the most important part is you better honor that. You know, if someone tells you and spills the beans to you, it's not for you to go tell your family. It's not for you to go tell your significant other unless it's like a life or death or, you know, some sort of thing that they need to be aware of. And it's definitely not for you to go take it back to the water cooler at the station or at the department or anything like that and share. It is not. You break anonymity, that's a good way to just say, hey, why don't I just put that final nail in your coffin? Because that's really what's going to happen, folks. So you really do need to be aware of what you're trying to do. But there's other ways you guys can approach that and really try to de-escalate. Have them, you know, a lot of people don't know how to do that, you know, by having them tap on their, hey, I'm just going to tap on my thighs and then I'm going to shake it out or go for a walk. I'm going to swallow, you know, I'm going to take a drink and I see you taking a drink. Like these are all ways to reset our nervous system. And that's ultimately what we need to do. We need to hit the reset button. We just can't hit the reset button ourselves. And so keep trying, folks. Don't get discouraged. A lot of people out there, that is a kind of common response. Like they're just like, they're super dickish. Like they'll just come after you. But just know, once again, that was the reason why you approached them, because something is not right. This is what we call trauma-informed approaches.
Mm-hmm. It also doesn't hurt, you know, of course, assuming that one is willing to talk about their experiences. If they're talking to someone that's gone through something similar to what they have, sharing those experiences is monumental in someone who feels alone. Have you read the book, The Body Keeps the Score?
Oh, you better believe it, Morgan. Like that is like my all-time... If you need to read a book and understand why you're behaving or acting the way you are, and you think you might have some sort of trauma, I would highly, highly recommend that book.
Yes. Yes. I call it kind of the Bible of trauma-informed care, or the Bible of trauma, actually.
Absolutely.
But there's a phrase or a statement that's made in there called shared pain is pain halved. And when we share our pain amongst folks who are not only living in it, but have experienced it, we develop a sense of community, which is essentially how we recover. For anyone who is helping someone who's really going through it, being willing to talk about your own experiences is monumental in helping someone who feels alone when they feel that no one else is experiencing this. That I definitely could have used that when I was going through it.
And I understand that, you know, and that's why we do these episodes, Morgan. We really do have some transparent conversations, and I don't shy away from anything. I think a lot of people, if you've listened or to any of the podcasts that I've done here at Critical Conversations or other podcasts, like I recently did one with Sam Brawley and the 911 nonsense. And I shared more in that episode than I ever had, at least publicly before. And there's a lot of stuff in there that a lot of people are going to be kind of shocked on. So if you haven't, go check out that episode and listen to it if you really want to understand my true story. But it is important. It's important to tell people, now, while I may not be in the shit with you right now, right? I am not having those pains, those feelings, that overwhelming sense of depression or anxiety or fear or whatever is going on. I have sat in it before, and it's not comfortable. And you know, hey, this is my story. I tried to kill myself twice. And, you know, I was an alcoholic and I had a short temper. I was not a great human. I don't think I was a great dad, a great person, a friend, a coworker. That's okay. You know, and that's where the emotional kind of hangover comes from, because when you start getting better, you're like, oh man, you just see all the damage you left behind, because we did. But I've accepted that with grace, right? And you could either choose to go back to the fog, I call it, or back in the spire and hide in the smoke, or you can continue to go forward and have someone that has been in that fire with you before or down in that pit help you and guide you. And I do think that sharing your story and sharing stories of others really do, it does make an impact, because people can realize like, okay, because one of the biggest things that they ask themselves is like, is this normal? Am I alone? Like, cause that's where a lot of people think like, oh, this only happens to me. Like, cause that's what your brain tells you, you know, your other, you know, amygdala kind of kicks in and he's like, yeah, this is all you, man. Like everybody's out to get you. And really you're not alone. So when we say, hey, it's okay to not be okay, it's also to remember, like, you're never alone, whether you think you are, where you think this is this is only happening to you. I can 100% assure you, being and doing what I've been doing for the last few years with Mind the Frontline, that couldn't be further for the truth. And it's also the inspiration that one of our volunteers came up with, Nick Carson. He came up with this book project that we're trying to do, because what we're trying to do is have people tell their story. One, it's very therapeutic to get your story out, whether it's video, audio, recording, writing, typing, whatever that is. But we're hoping to capture stories of different first responders through different, you know, adverse events and traumatic events, whether it be marriage, substance abuse, suicide, attempted suicide, you know, but also, you know, their story of resilience. You know, how did they get through this? Because at the bottom of each section is going to be what Nick calls, I'm not going to take it from, you know, hey, what was your Batman tool belt? You know, what what were the resources, like the books that, you know, the Bike Keep Score, what were the things that pulled you out or that you used? And then what we're going to do is we're going to have a mental health professional kind of do a chapter summary. And, you know, I really do hope it's going to be beneficial for a lot of people. You know, we got the Craig Hanley on board with the, he was part of the Beyond EMS Broken project. I can't remember the exact title, but he's going to be helping us out a little bit too with some of the graphics and some of the photos. But this is why we do it. You know, when I listen to somebody else's story and I realize like where they were and I start seeing some of that in myself, I'm like, oh shit, like there goes the red flags. Like, oh man, maybe this is me too. Then you could become aware, and awareness, you know, awareness is half the battle because it allows me to kind of, okay, well now I'm armed with awareness. Now it's just getting those tools to go forward and, you know, really start practicing recovery. And it is, it's a practice. It's something like you mentioned, I have to do every day. It's not something I try to skip. I don't let it kind of fall off just like going to the gym. Like I got to take care of my brain first before I can do anything else. Because if I don't take care of my brain, doesn't matter how much physical fitness I have, it doesn't how much, you know, sleep I get, diet, you know, how much of a great guy I might think I am. It's not going to take care of myself. So looking at resilience and supporting resilience in first responders, you know, what are some of the things that you would recommend? You know, how can I support the resilience of someone that is in the pit right now, or they're feeling like they're on fire and they just don't know how to get out of it?
For someone who is living in their recovery, attempting to help someone who may not be living in recovery, I mentioned earlier the power of presence, but, you know, being willing to invite them with you to your group, or, you know, maybe assisting them in looking for something that would fit them, that would be pretty decent in my opinion. I mean, the power of presence, it goes a long way. The other thing that I would like to
mention, showing up.
Yeah, just showing up. But when we talk about mental health crisis and, you know, PTSD or even depression, anxiety, or, you know, maybe even bipolar disorder, here in Georgia, we just recently passed a piece of legislation, House Bill 752. And it is the Advanced Psychiatric Directives. And one thing that is very monumental about this particular document is that this gives the person experiencing crisis so much more control and autonomy over their experiences. And what this document includes is it goes over their symptoms, who to contact, who not to contact, what hospital they're willing to go to, what hospital they're not willing to go to, what they look like when they're well, what they look like when they're not well, who their therapists are, who, what medications they take, what medications they won't take, and what those adverse reactions are. And so this document puts all of that information in there for in the event and proactively for when a crisis happens, the first responder or the hospital staff or whoever it is that is responding to this person's crisis now has a piece of paper telling them exactly what's going on and how to help that person. I find it to be just absolutely monumental. I give a copy to damn near everybody, honestly, especially those that I see for mental health counseling. Because when you're, I don't want to say when you're necessarily when you're well, especially when there's a possibility of a crisis happening, but when someone is able to use the prefrontal cortex and their rational brain to be able to advocate for themselves, goes a long, long way. But also I feel like it helps the first responders themselves. Because, you know, first responders aren't mental health clinicians, or at least not all of them are. And so for them to be able to be handed a piece of paper similar to a DNR, it's an advanced directive, it tells them how to handle this situation. And it can lessen the anxiety or the burden of having to deal with something that is very chaotic.
I think it takes away some of the challenges, right? Because you, it's like a pre-plan. If I go, you know, back when I was a firefighter, if I went as engineer to go pump a building and I knew where this building was, I knew where the hydrants were, I knew where to, you know, hook up to the FDC, I was a lot less stressed than coming up on a building that I'd never, you know, scoped out before or done an interior on, because you never know, you know, especially on commercial buildings. Like some of those buildings are, you know, they're death traps. They can be. So I think it's extremely important. And I, you know, I think this is one of many new directives that we're seeing coming out that will actually make an impact. I hope it does, because if I have this, you know, pre-plan about my mental health, one, it gives me a little bit of control, which gives me feeling, right, a little bit of safety, right? And that's kind of how we get out of that fight or flight is, hey, I can be safe because I have this document and it directs kind of the care and what I do and where I don't want to go. And more importantly, you know, it allows people to do the research ahead of time. So here's my shameless plug on every episode. If you don't have a therapist, grab a therapist, folks, because the average rate right now is about 4 to 8 weeks, depending on what part of the country you're in. And you might wait 4 to 8 weeks while you're sitting in the crap and really feeling down, just to find out that this provider is not someone that you want to sit with. And so, you know, by going out now and pre-planning and finding someone that you can connect with, that when, because it's not, you know, it's never going to happen. It's just a matter of when, right? We all go through different various intensities of this, but when you hit that moment, you know, you can really pick up the phone and have someone that you could call that can hopefully get you in that earliest convenience. But at the same time, when I, you know, my last suicide attempt in January of 2021, honestly, you know, I didn't have any pre-planning. I just thought, you know, wishful thinking on Chris, and now knowing what I know and why I've created the Mind in the Frontline, is I didn't have those resources pre-planned. I didn't know what was a good behavioral health hospital or a good place for me to go if I had a critical event or a sentinel event, or I was in crisis, which I was. You know, unfortunately, I didn't have any control. They basically just said, hey, Chris, like, we're transferring you from the ER where I was down to, you know, I'm going to say the facility because I think they're just total garbage. I would never go to this place. So if you're in Utah, do not put this thing on your list. But Provo Behavioral Health Hospital, they basically stuck me in there with a bunch of people detoxing from substance abuse. I was the only one there that decided that they wanted to end their life. And I basically just got to sit in the shit and cause even more trauma to myself. But having that pre-planned document, having that ability to go, hey, I've looked and done some research. I've asked around maybe a little bit. And it's also why we created Mind the Frontlines, you know, state-by-state resources. Like, we want to crowdsource. So if you're listening to this, if you have a trauma a facility or a behavioral health hospital or a therapist, I highly invite you to go over to our website and click on the resource tab and submit that resource. What we are trying to do is create an online catalog that is for every state or national, you know, national resources as well. That's where we have Copline. But really just kind of, hey, if I need to research this stuff, I can go to a website, a vetted organization that is like me, has walked the walk, has been in that trauma, is full of frontline first responders, from dispatchers to police officers to veterans to firefighters to air medical to EMS. We got them all, folks, you know, except for a lifeguard. I'm still looking. So if you're a lifeguard, and a ski patroller, animal control officer, and corrections. I think those are the four that we're still missing out on our community, but we'd love to have you guys join. But essentially, like, being able to look up those resources ahead of time and having a pre-plan, because when you get into crisis, like you said, sometimes, you know, like your accident, for example, like you get an accident, like, you know exactly where you are. You just can't articulate that. You just can't formulate the words to tell people. But if I could just go, like, here's this document, you know, it does help. And I love that they're taking lead on that. And I just, you know, I would love to see the numbers and kind of the research behind it to see and track the program overall, because maybe it's something we need to be rolling out and making it, you know, take it to a national level, you know, and making sure that every frontline first responder is required. Just like I got to fill out my W-2, I'm required to fill out this document, because it does kind of force them to start looking at themselves, A, you know, where am I at, kind of checking in, and B, just it provides a little bit of a safe place, you know, when they hit that crisis mode.
Absolutely. One last thing that I want to give as far as perspective, and I'm not saying that it's an absolute, I don't like to talk in absolutes, But I know that a lot of departments in fire and EMS, but also police, is chaplains. You know, chaplains usually come in when someone may be experiencing crisis. The only perspective, one of the perspectives I want to give is that folks often, and I'm not going to say a percentage or anything, but often folks who attempt suicide have lost their faith. They have lost their faith. It's a traumatic subject for some folks, myself included. And I say that because I am married to a Christian counselor. And he has walked with me, alongside me, through some, you know, church hurt or, you know, Bible trauma or those kinds of things. And while I love that that option is available in most agencies, it's something to take into perspective if someone is in crisis. They don't respond well because maybe some of their traumatic experiences included faith-based. And I'm not saying that it doesn't come full circle, because it does, but just, just kind of have it in the back of the mind.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of folks who attempt
suicide, keep in the back of mind, you know, I think if you keep it in the back of your mind, Morgan, and you're right, a lot of the people have kind of lost their way. They've lost their purpose. And we just did a great episode 6. If you haven't checked it out, folks, go check it out. But the power of meaning and purpose, you know, we've lost our purpose. And it's one of the things that I talk about. You know, whether you believe in a specific religion, a denomination, I don't care. Higher power, the universe, you know, that's kind of my jam, you know, and I've been, you know, I've been LDS, I've been Catholic, I've been Baptist, like I've been baptized all three. So gosh, my sins have been cleaned. No, I'm just kidding. But at the end of the day, like having something that you believe in is extremely important, because if you don't have a purpose, you don't feel fulfilled. You're never going to find that. And I think that it's something I've been holding on to for a talk I got coming up, and I'm going to do an episode around that. But yeah, I do see what you're saying. You know, when I believe in something, it gives me that extra little, you know, higher power lift, you know, whatever you want to call that, you know, and it doesn't necessarily, you don't have to be religious by any freaking means, people. Practicing Buddhism, practicing meditation, just believing that there is something else bigger out there. It could be black energy if you're a Stephen Hawking fan. You know, it could be the Empire, or if you're Star Wars, just something that is beyond you that you can kind of wake up and kind of, you know, give it away. You know, I do it all the time. You know, I talk in my head, or I'll talk out loud. You know, if I'm having a heavy day, you know, I'll just be like, you know, higher power, universe, whatever's out there, you know, whether you believe it or not, just say the words. I promise you, you'll feel better afterwards. Trust me. But hey, I'm feeling overwhelmed today. I got a lot of things, or I'm in a funk. I'm really depressed, and I just don't know how to get out of this. The world is coming down on me. Can you please just help me, guide me, take it away? And it's, you know, it took practice. I'm not saying it's something, you know, at first I thought it was kind of corny and something I really didn't want to do. But, you know, as I practiced it, it's something actually I incorporate in almost daily, you know, because if I get in a situation, it's just a mental offload of just going like, okay, cool. I said it, I got it out of the way, and it's out there. Like, okay. And I actually just don't worry about it anymore. Like, that's the beauty of it. Like, I just, it goes away. And it's something that I think is not practiced enough in recovery. And one of those key things, especially early on, trying to find that purpose and that meaning. And if you're looking for something to read, The Power of Meaning is actually a phenomenal book that I just got done reading. That highlights a lot of the stuff that I've talked about. And there's a lot of good research from Berkeley, Yale, overseas, that really do show the difference of when people have a meaning in life versus what happens to people that don't have meaning in life. So I would just recommend you read the book.
Yeah. So I heard you mention building your resource list and such. Are you familiar with the National Alliance on Mental Illness?
The National, say that one more time.
The National Alliance on Mental Illness, NAMI.
NAMI. Yes, I am. Actually, Cindy Jones used to be one of the regional presidents or directors or something like that. So yes, I'm becoming more and more familiar with NAMI.
Okay. NAMI has a frontline wellness. I call it a chapter. I'm not sure what NAMI specifically calls it, but frontline wellness. It is specific for fire, EMS, LEO, ER physicians. And I have worked very hard to bring frontline wellness to Georgia. And part of the frontline wellness stuff is they have a workshop, a couples workshop for firefighter couples. They also have peer support implementation, leadership training. So that it is used to equip agencies to implement peer support into their agencies. But then also, hopefully in April, I will be rolling out an online connection support group specific for frontline wellness. So I will be running a statewide online support group specific to first responders. And I'm very excited about it. I'm honored that, NAMI Georgia has allowed me to kind of take this on. So that is an option to add to your list, especially for the state of Georgia. And then
send it full send over here. Now, question, Morgan, real quick, is it, obviously I live in Utah, but you're telling me this is online. Like, am I able to take advantage of this peer support group? Because we do get questions all the time from our members, like, about having, and it's something I've thought about setting up for Mind the Front Line. However, I don't want to, necessarily reinvent the wheel if there's a really good wheel out there that we could kind of partner up with. So I would absolutely be interested, like, hey, can anyone join this meeting, even though it's, in Georgia and part of the Georgia chapter? But if it's online, can anybody join?
I don't see why not, but I would be happy to follow up on that and let you know, just so for promotional information and what have you. I certainly, the more the merrier. Especially, utilizing this particular resource. I will absolutely follow up with you on that one. And I highly encourage, anyone who is, interested in NAMI to not only join, but to inquire about becoming a frontline wellness ambassador and being more involved in the frontline wellness stuff, because, the couples workshop and the peer support leadership training is a great way to get hands-on and face-to-face with folks.
No, I like it. I'm definitely going to look into it and reach out to them, because now I've done two episodes back-to-back with some NAMI members, and it's just something that I like to collaborate and see if there's ways to partner up with awesome organizations doing great things, because I think as long as we can make that net wider and we all do something really well, why not? Why not? Do they offer the online program in any other states that you're aware of, the online support group, by chance?
Yes. The connection support group should be available in every state through the whole country. NAMI is nationwide. I think the bare minimum is just seeking out your state's affiliate, and there should be a calendar posted on the NAMI, like whatever your state is on the NAMI website, with dates and times of both not only online, but in-person meetings as well.
Awesome. So online and in person. I love it. That seems like a great resource. So I can't wait to look more into it and get some of that information from you and how we can share that. And absolutely for those Mind the Frontline members and just community members in Georgia to try to add that to our Georgia state list. So, I do want to kind of bring the show to a little bit of a close. But before we go, there's two more topics I want to kind of address. I want to address addressing secondary traumatic stress. When we talk about secondary traumatic stress, also known as compassion fatigue, because compassion fatigue could happen to you, but also like I recognize compassion fatigue in my wife as she struggled with her alcoholic, traumatic husband and first responder over the many years. You know, it does become something that is regular. I think it's something that doesn't have a lot of love or get a lot of attention. And I do have an episode coming up just on secondary traumatic stress. But I do know that like when you have first responders that regularly witness these traumatic, you know, events like we talk about, we look at those secondary traumatic stresses among personnel. And that could be your partner. That could be leadership. That could be your family, your friends. What are your thoughts about, you know, just secondary traumatic stress? You know, how can I, how do I know if I might be experiencing it? And B, what are some good ways to maybe navigate that?
Prioritizing debriefing is a big one. Prioritizing talking after a critical incident, or even follow-ups. I strongly believe that debriefings are crucial in how we absorb secondary trauma. Being able to debrief from something and be able to, I mean, it goes down to neurological. When we have a debrief after a critical incident, yeah, we're able to reset our nervous system. Then we can go home because we've debriefed. We can go home and not be the asshole parent. We can go home and be able to articulate to our spouse what happened. And those I feel are and monumental, how we're feeling, because it is so deep rooted in the benefits of being able to do a proper debrief. But not only that, but agency supporting post-critical incident seminars. We have those here in Georgia. They are offered through the Department of Public Safety, and they host retreats. Like it's either bi-yearly or quarterly. Having agency support to go into one of those is monumental, because not only are you providing a type of resource for this particular person, but you're extending a token of caring, you know, retention. That is big in retention. When people actually feel like their command staff gives a shit, they're going to stay and they're going to improve the, you know, their profession. And it helps resiliency, being able to bounce back. You know, it's inevitable that when we do this job, we're going to experience traumatic events. We're going to experience adverse events. We're going to have those moments. But when we are supported and we have a healthy support, you know, in the process of dealing with these things, we're able to bounce back quicker. I'm not saying that it's the end all be all, and just because you go to a post-critical incident seminar or just because you do a debriefing that it's not going to still mess with somebody, but the impact is lesser.
I couldn't agree more. I would even go so far as, you know, for me, I always, as the leader and a business owner and a CEO, I firmly believe that culture is king. And by setting a good, healthy, safe culture, it just organically kind of comes together. You know, it's when we have these toxic cultures where, once again, I don't feel safe. I don't feel supported. I've shown the statistics in some of my talks where when you have someone like that, the likelihood of them leaving or committing suicide is very, very high. And it's just because that toxic culture it doesn't give you that opportunity to once again have that momentary pause, take that deep breath. And when you do, there's someone there right there in a toxic culture to push your head right back underneath the water. And there's only so many times that you could waterboard somebody before they just give up. And so I do think it's correct. And I love how you kind of put it. And it's why we do retreats. You know, it's why we have the debrief hotline, 866-MIND-247. If you guys want to debrief and not take this home, we have a retreat coming up in August up in Bozeman, Montana, along the Johnson River. You know, it's just, there's many organizations that do little things like this. And it's just allowing individuals to find out about that information. So once again, I'll be probably pinging you on some of these things to go, hey, can we get these resources or know about when these events are happening? Because we want to get that out to the masses so that way they can take care of it and take advantage of it. Because if you have a good, and if you're a leader in a leadership or administrative position, you know, what you do and how you do it, you know, does matter. Culture is absolutely king. And I also realize that there also are leaders that are also equally struggling sometimes and they have unresolved trauma. And I have to approach that with a trauma-informed awareness to go, hey, maybe they just don't understand, or maybe they're struggling themselves. And it's really hard to save others when you can't even save yourself. I mean, that's usually one of the first things we try to do. That's why we got into this. I do think the hero complex does play a part in our inability to recover sometimes because, hey, no, I got this, you know, the machismoism that, you know, paramedics walk on water, or, you know, law enforcement officers, they just remind me of Paunch on Chips. They're just, you know, walking just models. But at the same time, I do see a lot of benefits from having a good culture, being able to get out, having a retreat, and debrief. Like debriefs are huge. And I think what people don't realize, like, is you don't need to call, you know, the Mind the Frontline debrief number. I really actually do encourage, like, you know, crew debriefs. You know, it could be between you and your EMT partner, your law enforcement partner. If you're in a hospital and you're listening to this, like, this is your nurse team, you know, the night shift, you know, you guys could all come together and debrief. And I do think certain lines do it a lot better. You know, I hear about law enforcement officers getting bread, you know, getting together for breakfast beforehand or after a shift. You know, as firefighters, I used to do that all the time. And that allows you to kind of blow some of this stuff off and not take it home. And what people don't realize is by doing these little things, you know, at the crew level, you know, it builds that cohesiveness and that culture and that community, that sense of belonging. Because I will tell you, one of the other statistics I talk about is if you don't feel like you belong a part of your tribe, man, once again, those numbers statistically, and I don't have them off the top of my head, but I do know it's well over 100% as far as burnout and leaving the industry or leaving the position. And I also want to, you know, highlight, because sometimes, as you know, I'm a former firefighter paramedic. I'm also a paramedic. I'm a flight paramedic. But, you know, we have different lines. And I really want to encourage people listening to this to start thinking about how can we collaborate across disciplines, right? Like, we would actually start, I remember when I was working as a firefighter down in Tucson, at Drexel Heights, you know, we would get Pima County Sheriff's Department and we, you know, hey, come join us for dinner. We would bring them at our shift dinner at night, you know, like, we're all cooking dinner. Why don't you guys stop by if you're on a call, come hang out with us, right? Because, you know, and the really hard thing is don't forget about, like, the dispatchers. They keep getting left out, but think about how isolated they are and how little resources they have for the ability to do some of these things and have that sense of community, because usually some dispatchers are very large. I get that. But some of the other ones are usually small and they just don't have the ability to do some of these little things. So how do you do it? You know, make the time. You make the time. Get on your calendar, because if it's on your calendar, it's happening, right? And all it takes is someone just saying, hey, I set up this event for next Saturday, be there, be square. That's it. Like, that's all. It just takes someone to make that one little step. But I really would like to challenge our viewers and listeners today to really start thinking about your brothers and sisters on the other lines, right? You know, the dispatchers out there. If you're a firefighter, think about the nurses and the physicians, or the law enforcement officers, correctional officers, lifeguards, ski patrollers, animal correction officers. Like, sometimes they look like, and they feel like they're like the stepchild, right? They're like wannabe real cops, I've heard them called. And really, they're just like us. They want to do good in this world. And maybe that is the step that they want to do. Or maybe they just really love being of service to animals because that's their passion. But don't leave them out. You know, I think if we could do more events, more of these retreats where it's not just EMS or it's not just fire, but hey, it's a blend. It's a community of all of us. I think we could all learn from each other.
I agree.
Well, Morgan, this has been a great, insightful conversation. Is there anything else, any other thoughts you have that you want to make sure that we cover before we wrap up today's show?
I don't think so. I've talked about everything that I had set out to chat about. I really appreciate being able to kind of share my story and how it's, you know, kind of the foundation of all the things that I do and, you know, clinical knowledge and all that fun stuff. So I feel like my story kind of brings my interest alive a little bit.
Well, it also shows people where you are now does not need to necessarily define where you're going, you know, and you're a walk and talking example of that, Morgan. Like, what you've been through would break so many people, but you have found that resiliency day in and day out, that 1%, that putting my foot in front of the other, and you have done a phenomenal job. And not only that, you're paying it forward. You know, now that you've kind of gotten out of the fog, and trust me, I'm in recovery myself every day. I got my own therapist. I got my own support groups that I go see, sometimes even nightly online, just because I need it, you know. And so kudos to you for having the vulnerability and the transparency to come on and the bravery, really, to come in and share your story so others can see that. Because who knows? You might be inspiring the next person, A, to A, get help, or B, to seek out and maybe become a trauma, you know, informed therapist. Because I'll tell you, you know, what we do need, and after talking with like Dan Cohen with Montgomery County EMS and the hospital district down there, when we were talking about peer support, is we really do need more first responder therapists that have walked the line on the other side of the fence to talk to, because that's honestly, you know, cultural competency, I can't stress enough. And there just isn't enough of us to go around, unfortunately, right now. And so if you're looking for something to do and you're towards the end of your career or you're looking for a shift, you know, I highly encourage you to maybe look into therapists and being a professional guidance counselor or a social worker, something like that, to be on the other side, to continue to help the brothers and sisters that are in the fire or in the pit or, you know, wherever they might be. And if you are listening to this and you are struggling, I highly encourage that you reach out to somebody saying help. There's no greater honorability or nobility, in my personal opinion, than saying I need help. It's also the hardest thing to do, but know that your brothers and sisters are out here. We do care. We see you, and we're going to continue to do what we can to help out through all of these initiatives. So thank you so much, Morgan, for coming on today's show, sharing your experience, being vulnerable, and really just arming us with a little bit more information and education about trauma-informed care. I would definitely like to express my sincere gratitude. Your knowledge, you know, just continues to elevate our mission and our story and our communication to get this out there to everybody listening and really promote the mental health and wellness and recovery of first responders. So with that, let's continue to have these critical conversations together and build a stronger, more resilient first responder community. Thank you so much for being a part of Critical Conversations by Mind the Frontline. Until next time, take care, stay strong, and mind the frontline.
To our dedicated listeners, thank you again for joining us on this critical journey. Remember, the Critical Conversations podcast is a steadfast resource for police, fire, EMS, allied healthcare workers, dispatchers, air medical, and military personnel, along with their families. Your support makes the impact of these conversations resonate even further. If you found today's discussion enlightening and want to stay connected with our ongoing mission, please be sure to subscribe to the Critical Conversations podcast. You can find us via Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the Mind the Frontline website. Your subscription ensures that you will never miss an episode, and it's a powerful way to show your commitment to fostering resilience within the entire first responder community. For more information and additional resources, visit our website at www.mindthefrontline.org. Together, let's continue these critical conversations and build a stronger, more resilient first responder family. We thank you for being a part of the Critical Conversations podcast. Until next time, take care, stay strong, and mind the frontline.